I had not wanted her to come, nor even thought of her, and I didn't turn away from the fire to look at her. But there was a powerful understanding between us. When I had tried to escape this house and been brought back, it was she who had shown me the way out of the pain that followed. Miracles she'd worked for me, though no one around us had ever noticed. Her first intervention had come when I was 12, and the old parish priest, who had taught me some poetry by rote and to read an anthem or two in Latin, wanted to send me to school at the nearby monastery. My father said no, that I could learn all I needed in my own house, but it was my mother who roused herself from her books to do loud and vociferous battle with him. I would go, she said, if I wanted to, and she sold one of her jewels to pay for my books and clothing. Her jewels had all come down to her from an Italian grandmother, and each had its story, and this was a hard thing for her to do, but she did it immediately. My father was angry, and reminded her that if this had happened before he went blind, his will would have prevailed, surely. My brothers assured him that his youngest son wouldn't be gone long. I'd come running home as soon as I was made to do something I didn't want to do. Well, I didn't come running home. I loved the monastery school. I loved the chapel and the hymns, the library with its thousands of old books, the bells that divided the day, the ever-repeated rituals. I loved the cleanliness of the place, the overwhelming fact that all things here were well kept and in good repair, that work never ceased throughout the great house and the gardens. When I was corrected, which wasn't often, I knew an intense happiness because someone for the first time in my life was trying to make me into a good person, one who could learn things. Within a month, I declared my vocation. I wanted to enter the order. I wanted to spend my life in those immaculate cloisters, in the library, writing on parchment and learning to read the ancient books. I wanted to be enclosed forever with people who believed I could be good if I wanted to be. I was liked there, and that was a most unusual thing. I didn't make other people there unhappy or angry. The Father Superior wrote immediately to ask my father's permission, and frankly I thought my father would be glad to be rid of me. But 3 days later, my brothers arrived to take me home with them. I cried and begged to stay, but there was nothing the Father Superior could do. And as soon as we reached the castle, my brothers took away my books and locked me up. I didn't understand why they were so angry. There was the hint that I had behaved like a fool for some reason. I couldn't stop crying. I was walking round and round and smashing my fist into things and kicking the door. But then my brother Augustin started coming in and talking to me. He'd circled the point at first, but what came clear finally was that no member of a great French family was going to be a poor teaching brother. How could I have misunderstood everything so completely? I was sent there to learn to read and write. Why did I always have to go to extremes? Why did I behave habitually like a wild creature? As for becoming a priest with real prospects within the church, well, I was the youngest son of this family now, wasn't I? I ought to think of my duties to my nieces and nephews. Translate all that to mean this. We have no money to launch a real ecclesiastical career for you, to make you a bishop or cardinal as befits our rank, so you have to live out your life here as an illiterate and a beggar. Come in the great hall and play chess with your father. After I got to understand it, I wept right at the supper table, and mumbled words no one understood about this house of ours being chaos, and was sent back to my room for it. Then my mother came to me. She said, "You don't know what chaos is. Why do you use words like that?" "I know," I said. I started to describe to her the dirt and the decay that was everywhere here, and to tell how the monastery had been clean and orderly, a place where if you set your mind to it, you could accomplish something. She didn't argue, and young as I was, I knew that she was warming to the unusual quality of what I was saying to her. The next morning she took me on a journey. We rode for half a day before we reached the impressive chateau of a neighbouring lord, and there she and the gentleman took me out to the kennel, where she told me to choose my favourites from a new litter of mastiff puppies. I have never seen anything as tender and endearing as these little mastiff pups, and the big dogs were like drowsy lions as they watched us, simply magnificent. I was too excited almost to make the choice. I brought back the male and female that the Lord advised me to pick, carrying them all the way home on my lap in a basket. And within a month, my mother also bought for me my first flintlock musket and my first good horse for riding. She never said why she'd done all this, but I understood in my own way what she had given me. I raised those dogs, trained them, and founded a great kennel upon them. I became a true hunter with those dogs, and by the age of 16 I lived in the field. But at home, I was more than ever a nuisance. Nobody really wanted to hear me talk of restoring the vineyards, or replanting the neglected fields, or of making the tenants stop stealing from us. I could affect nothing. The silent ebb and flow of life without change seemed deadly to me. I went to church on all the feast days just to break the monotony of life, and when the village fairs came round, I was always there, greedy for the little spectacles I saw at no other time. Anything, really, to break the routine. It might be the same old jugglers, mimes, and acrobats of years past, but it didn't matter. It was something more than the change of the seasons and the idle talk of past glories. But that year, the year I was 16, a troop of Italian players came through, with a painted wagon in back of which they set up the most elaborate stage I'd ever seen. They put on the old Italian comedy with Pantaloon and Pulcinella, and the young lovers Lelio and Isabella, and the old doctor, and all the old tricks. I was in raptures watching it. I'd never seen anything like it. The cleverness of it, the quickness, the vitality. I loved it, even when the words went so fast I couldn't follow them. When the troupe had finished and collected what they could from the crowd, I hung about with them at the inn and stood them all to wine I couldn't really afford, just so that I could talk to them. I felt inexpressible love for these men and women. They explained to me how each actor had his role for life, and how they did not use memorized words, but improvised everything on the stage. You knew your name, your character, and you understood him and made him speak and act as you thought he should. That was the genius of it. It was called the Commedia dell'arte. I was enchanted. I fell in love with the young girl who played Isabella. I went into the wagon with the players and examined all the costumes and the painted scenery, and when we were drinking again at the tavern, they let me act out Lelio, the young lover, to Isabella, and they clapped their hands and said I had the gift. I could make it up the way they did. I thought this was all flattery at first, but in some very real way it didn't matter whether or not it was flattery. The next morning, when their wagon pulled out of the village, I was in it. I was hidden in the back with a few coins I'd managed to save and all my clothes tied in a blanket. I was going to be an actor. Now, Lelio in the old Italian comedy is supposed to be quite handsome. He's the lover, as I have explained, and he doesn't wear a mask. If he has manners, dignity, aristocratic bearing, so much the better, because that's part of the role. Well, the troupe thought that in all these things I was blessed. They trained me immediately for the next performance they would give, and the day before we put on the show I went about the town, a much larger and more interesting place than our village, to be certain, advertising the play with the others. I was in heaven. But neither the journey nor the preparations, nor the camaraderie with my fellow players came near to the ecstasy I knew when I finally stood on that little wooden stage. I went wildly into the pursuit of Isabella. I found a tongue for verses and wit I'd never had in life. I could hear my voice bouncing off the stone walls around me. I could hear the laughter rolling back at me from the crowd. They almost had to drag me off the stage to stop me, but everyone knew it had been a great success. That night, the actress who played my inamorata gave me her own very special and intimate accolades. I went to sleep in her arms. And the last thing I remember her saying was that when we got to Paris, we'd play the Saint-Germain Fair, and then we'd leave the troupe, and we'd stay in Paris, working on the Boulevard du Temple, until we got into the Comédie Française itself and performed for Marie Antoinette and King Louis. When I woke up the next morning, she was gone, and so were all the players, and my brothers were there. I never knew if my friends had been bribed to give me over, or just frightened off. More likely the latter. Whatever the case, I was taken back home again. Of course, my family was perfectly horrified at what I'd done. Wanting to be a monk when you are 12 is excusable, but the theatre had the taint of the devil. Even the great Molière had not been given a Christian burial. And I'd run off with a troupe of ragged, vagabond Italians, painted my face white, and acted with them in a town square for money. I was beaten, severely. And when I cursed everyone, I was beaten again. The worst punishment, however, was seeing the look on my mother's face. I hadn't even told her I was going, and I had wounded her, a thing that had never really happened before. But she never said anything about it. When she came to me, she listened to me cry. I saw tears in her eyes, and she laid her hand on my shoulder, which for her was something a little remarkable. I didn't tell her what it had been like those few days, but I think she knew. Something magical had been lost utterly. And once again, she defied my father. She put an end to the condemnations, the beatings, the restrictions. She had me sit beside her at the table. She deferred to me, actually talked to me in conversation that was perfectly unnatural to her, until she had subdued and dissolved the rancor of the family. Finally, as she had in the past, she produced another of her jewels, and she bought the fine hunting rifle that I had taken with me when I killed the wolves. This was a superior and expensive weapon, and in spite of my misery, I was fairly eager to try it. And she added to that another gift, a sleek chestnut mare with strength and speed I'd never known in an animal before. But these things were small compared to the general consolation my mother had given me. Yet the bitterness inside me did not subside. I never forgot what it had been like when I was Lelio. I became a little crueler for what had happened, and I never, never went again to the village fair. I conceived of the notion that I should never get away from here, and oddly enough, as my despair deepened, so my usefulness increased. I alone put the fear of God into the servants or tenants by the time I was 18. I alone provided the food for us, and for some strange reason this gave me satisfaction. I don't know why, but I liked to sit at the table and reflect that everyone there was eating what I had provided. So these moments had bound me to my mother. These moments had given us a love for each other unnoticed and probably unequalled in the lives of those around us. And now she had come to me at this odd time when, for reasons I didn't understand myself, I could not endure the company of any other person. With my eyes on the fire, I barely saw her climb up and sink down into the straw mattress beside me. Silence. Just the crackling of the fire, and the deep respiration of the sleeping dogs beside me. Then I glanced at her, and I was vaguely startled. She'd been ill all winter with a cough, and now she looked truly sickly, and her beauty, which was always very important to me, seemed vulnerable for the first time. Her face was angular, and her cheekbones perfect, very high and broadly spaced, but delicate. Her jawline was strong yet exquisitely feminine, and she had very clear, cobalt-blue eyes fringed with thick, ashen lashes. If there was any flaw in her, it was perhaps that all her features were too small, too kittenish, and made her look like a girl. Her eyes became even smaller when she was angry, and though her mouth was sweet, it often appeared hard. It did not turn down, it wasn't twisted in any way, it was like a little pink rose on her face. But her cheeks were very smooth and her face narrow, and when she looked very serious, her mouth, without changing at all, looked mean for some reason. Now she was slightly sunken, but she still looked beautiful to me. She still was beautiful. I liked looking at her, Her hair was full and blonde, and that I had inherited from her. In fact, I resemble her at least superficially, but my features are larger, cruder, and my mouth is more mobile and can be very mean at times. And you can see my sense of humor in my expression, my capacity for mischievousness, and near-hysterical laughing, which I've always had no matter how unhappy I was. She did not laugh often. She could look profoundly cold. Yet she had always a little girl's sweetness. Well, I looked at her as she sat on my bed. I even stared at her, I suppose, and immediately she started to talk to me. "I know how it is," she said to me. "You hate them, because of what you've endured and what they don't know. They haven't the imagination to know what happened to you out there on the mountain." I felt a cold delight in these words. I gave her the silent acknowledgement that she understood it perfectly. "It was the same the first time I bore a child," she said. "I was in agony for 12 hours, and I felt trapped in the pain, knowing the only release was the birth or my own death. When it was over, I had your brother Augustin in my arms, but I didn't want anyone else near me. And it wasn't because I blamed them. It was only that I'd suffered like that, hour after hour, that I'd gone into the circle of hell and come back out. They hadn't been in the circle of hell, and I felt quiet all over. In this common occurrence, this vulgar act of giving birth, I understood the meaning of utter loneliness." "Yes, that's it," I answered. I was a little shaken. She didn't respond. I would have been surprised if she had. Having said what she'd come to say, she wasn't going to converse, actually. But she did lay her hand on my forehead, very unusual for her to do that, and when she observed that I was wearing the same bloody hunting clothes after all this time, I noticed it too and realized the sickness of it. She was silent for a while, and as I sat there, looking past her at the fire, I wanted to tell her a lot of things, how much I loved her particularly. But I was cautious. She had a way of cutting me off when I spoke to her, and mingled with my love was a powerful resentment of her. All my life I'd watched her read her Italian books and scribble letters to people in Naples where she had grown up. Yet she had no patience even to teach me or my brothers the alphabet. And nothing had changed after I came back from the monastery. I was 20, and I couldn't read or write more than a few prayers and my name. I hated the sight of her books. I hated her absorption in them. And in some vague way, I hated the fact that only extreme pain in me could ever wring from her the slightest warmth or interest. Yet she'd been my savior, and there was no one but her. And I was as tired of being alone, perhaps, as a young person can be. She was here now, out of the confines of her library, and she was attentive to me. Finally, I was convinced that she wouldn't get up and go away, and I found myself speaking to her. "Mother," I said in a low voice, "there is more to it. Before it happened, there were times when I felt terrible things." There was no change in her expression. "I mean I dream sometimes that I might kill all of them," I said. "I kill my brothers and my father in the dream. I go from room to room slaughtering them as I did the wolves. I feel in myself the desire to murder." "So do I, my son," she said. "So do I." And her face was lighted with the strangest smile as she looked at me. I bent forward and looked at her more closely. I lowered my voice. "I see myself screaming when it happens," I went on. "I see my face twisted into grimaces, and I hear bellowing coming out of me. My mouth is a perfect O, and shrieks, cries come out of me." She nodded with that same understanding look, as if a light were flaring behind her eyes. "And on the mountain, Mother, when I was fighting the wolves, it was a little like that." "Only a little?" she asked. I nodded. "I felt like someone different from myself when I killed the wolves. And now I don't know who is here with you, your son Lestat, or that other man, the killer? She was quiet for a long time.
No, she said finally. It was you who killed the wolves. You're the hunter, the warrior. You're stronger than anyone else here. That's your tragedy.
I shook my head. That was true, but it didn't matter. It couldn't account for unhappiness such as this. But what was the use of saying it? She looked away for a moment, then back to me.
But you're many things, she said, not only one thing. You're the killer and the man. And don't give in to the killer in you just because you hate them. You don't have to take upon yourself the burden of murder or madness to be free of this place. Surely there must be other ways.
Those last two sentences struck me hard. She had gone to the core, and the implications dazzled me. Always I'd felt that I couldn't be a good human being and fight them. To be good meant to be defeated by them, unless, of course, I found a more interesting idea of goodness. We sat still for a few moments, and there seemed an uncommon intimacy, even for us. She was looking at the fire, scratching at her thick hair, which was wound into a circle on the back of her head.
"You know what I imagine?" she said, looking towards me again. "Not so much the murdering of them as an abandon which disregards them completely. I imagine drinking wine until I'm so drunk I strip off my clothes and bathe in the mountain streams naked."
I almost laughed, but it was a sublime amusement. I looked up at her, uncertain for a moment that I was hearing her correctly. But she had said these words, and she wasn't finished.
"And then I imagine going into the village," she said, "and up into the inn, and taking into my bed any men that come there, crude men, big men, old men, boys, just lying there and taking them one after another, and feeling some magnificent triumph in it, some absolute release without a thought of what happens to your father or your brothers, whether they are alive or dead. In that moment I am purely myself. I belong to no one."
I was too shocked and amazed to say anything. But again this was terribly, terribly amusing. When I thought of my father and brothers, and the pompous shopkeepers of the village, and how they would respond to such a thing, I found it damn near hilarious. If I didn't laugh aloud, it was probably because the image of my mother naked made me think I shouldn't. But I couldn't keep altogether quiet. I laughed a little, and she nodded, half-smiling. She raised her eyebrows as if to say, "We understand each other." Finally, I roared, laughing. I pounded my knee with my fist and hit my head on the wood of the bed behind me, and she almost laughed herself. Maybe, in her own quiet way, she was laughing. Curious moment. Some almost brutal sense of her as a human being quite removed from all that surrounded her. We did understand each other, and all my resentment of her didn't matter too much. She pulled the pin out of her hair and let it tumble down to her shoulders. We sat quiet for perhaps an hour after that. No more laughter or talk, just the fire blazing, and her near to me. She had turned so she could see the fire. Her profile, the delicacy of her nose and lips were beautiful to look at. Then she looked back at me, and in the same steady voice, without undue emotion, she said,
"I'll never leave here. I am dying now."
I was stunned. The little shock before was nothing to this.
"I'll live through this spring," she continued, "and possibly the summer as well. But I won't survive another winter, I know. The pain in my lungs is too bad."
I made some little anguished sound. I think I leaned forward and said,
"Mother." "Don't say any more," she answered.
I think she hated to be called mother, but I hadn't been able to help it.
"I just wanted to speak it to another soul," she said, "to hear it out loud. I'm perfectly horrified by it. I'm afraid of it."
I wanted to take her hands, but I knew she'd never allow it. She disliked to be touched. She never put her arms around anyone. And so it was in our glances that we held each other. My eyes filled with tears looking at her. She patted my hand.
"Don't think on it much," she said. "I don't. Just only now and then. But you must be ready to live on without me when the time comes. That may be harder for you than you realize."
I tried to say something. I couldn't make the words come. She left me just as she'd come in, silently. And though she'd never said anything about my clothes, or my beard, or how dreadful I looked, she sent the servants in with clean clothes for me and a razor and warm water. And silently, I let myself be taken care of by them.
3.
I began to feel a little stronger. I stopped thinking about what happened with the wolves, and I thought about her. I thought about the words, "perfectly horrified," and I didn't know what to make of them except they sounded exactly true. I'd feel that way if I were dying slowly. It would have been better on the mountain, with the wolves. But there was more to it than that. She had always been silently unhappy. She hated the inertia and the hopelessness of our life here as much as I did, and now, after 8 children, 3 living, 5 dead, she was dying. This was the end for her. I determined to get up, if it would make her feel better. But when I tried, I couldn't. The thought of her dying was unbearable. I paced the floor of my room a lot, ate the food brought to me, but still I wouldn't go to her. But by the end of the month, visitors came to draw me out. My mother came in and said I must receive the merchants from the village who wanted to honor me for killing the wolves. "Oh, hell with it," I answered.
"No, you must come down," she said. "They have gifts for you. Now do your duty." I hated all this.
When I reached the hall, I found the rich shopkeepers there, all men I knew well, and all dressed for the occasion. But there was one startling young man among them I didn't recognize immediately. He was my age, perhaps, and quite tall. And when our eyes met, I remembered who he was. Nicolas de L'Enfant. Eldest son of the draper, who had been sent to school in Paris. He was a vision now. Dressed in a splendid brocade coat of rose and gold, he wore slippers with gold heels and layers of Italian lace at his collar. Only his hair was what it used to be, dark and very curly and boyish-looking for some reason, though it was tied back with a fine bit of silk ribbon. Parisian fashion, all this. The sort that passed as fast as it could through the local post-house. And here I was to meet him in threadbare wool and scuffed leather boots and yellowed lace that had been 17 times mended. We bowed to each other, as he was apparently the spokesman for the town, and then he unwrapped from its modest covering of black serge a great red velvet cloak lined in fur. Gorgeous thing! His eyes were positively shining when he looked at me. You would have thought he was looking at a sovereign. "Monsieur, we beg you to accept this," he said very sincerely. "The finest fur of the wolves has been used to line it, and we thought it would stand you well in the winter, this fur-lined cloak, when you ride out to hunt." "And these too, monsieur," said his father, producing a finely sewn pair of fur-lined boots in black suede. "For the hunt, monsieur," he said.
I was a little overcome. They meant these gestures in the kindest way, these men who had the sort of wealth I only dreamed of, and they paid me respect as the aristocrat.
I took the cloak and the boots. I thanked them as effusively as I'd ever thanked anybody for anything. And behind me, I heard my brother Augustin say, "Now he will really be impossible." I felt my face color. Outrageous that he should say this in the presence of these men. But when I glanced to Nicolas de L'Enfant, I saw the most affectionate expression on his face.
"I too am impossible, monsieur," he whispered as I gave him the parting kiss. "Some day will you let me come to talk to you and tell me how you killed them all? Only the impossible can do the impossible."
None of the merchants ever spoke to me like that. We were boys again for a moment, and I laughed out loud. His father was disconcerted. My brothers stopped whispering, but Nicolas de L'Enfant kept smiling with a Parisian's composure. As soon as they had left, I took the red velvet cloak and the suede boots up into my mother's room. She was reading, as always, while very lazily she brushed her hair. In the weak sunlight from the window, I saw grey in her hair for the first time. I told her what Nicolas de L'Enfant had said. "Why is he impossible?" I asked her. "He said this with feeling, as if it meant something." She laughed. "It means something, all right," she said. "He's in disgrace." She stopped looking at her book for a moment and looked at me. "You know how he's been educated all his life to be a little imitation aristocrat. Well, during his first term studying law in Paris, he fell madly in love with a violin, of all things. Seems he heard an Italian virtuoso, one of those geniuses from Padua, who is so great that men say he has sold his soul to the devil. Well, Nicolas dropped everything at once to take lessons from Wolfgang Mozart. He sold his books. He did nothing but play, and play until he failed his examinations. He wants to be a musician, can you imagine?" "And his father is beside himself." "Exactly. He even smashed the instrument, and you know what a piece of expensive merchandise means to the good draper." I smiled. "And so Nicolas has no violin now?"
"He has a violin."
"He promptly ran away to Clermont and sold his watch to buy another. He's impossible, all right. And the worst part of it is that he plays rather well."
"You've heard him?"
She knew good music. She grew up with it in Naples. All I'd ever heard were the church choir, the players at the fairs.
"I heard him Sunday when I went to Mass," she said.
"He was playing in the upstairs bedroom over the shop. Everyone could hear him, and his father was threatening to break his hands." I gave a little gasp at the cruelty of it. I was powerfully fascinated. I think I loved him already, doing what he wanted like that.
"Of course he'll never be anything," she went on.
"Why not?"
"He's too old.
You can't take up the violin when you're 20. "But what do I know? He plays magically in his own way, and maybe he can sell his soul to the devil." I laughed a little uneasily. It sounded magic.
"But why don't you go down to the town and make a friend of him?" she asked.
"Why the hell should I do that?" I asked.
"Lestat, really. Your brothers will hate it, and the old merchant will be beside himself with joy, his son and the Marquis's son."
"Those aren't good enough reasons."
"He's been to Paris," she said.
She watched me for a long moment. Then she went back to her book, brushing her hair now and then lazily. I watched her reading it, hating it. I wanted to ask her how she was, if her cough was very bad that day, but I couldn't broach the subject to her.
"Go down and talk to him, Lestat," she said,
without another glance at me. 4. It took me a week to make up my mind that I would seek out Nicolas de L'Enfant. I put on the red velvet fur-lined cloak and fur-lined suede boots, and I went down the winding main street of the village towards the inn. The shop owned by Nicholas's father was right across from the inn, but I didn't see or hear Nicholas. I had no more than enough for one glass of wine, and I wasn't sure just how to proceed when the innkeeper came out, bowed to me, and set a bottle of his best vintage before me. Of course, these people had always treated me like the son of the Lord, but I could see that things had changed on account of the wolves, and strangely enough this made me feel even more alone than I usually felt. But as soon as I poured the first glass, Nicolas appeared, a great blaze of colour in the open doorway. He was not so finely dressed as before, thank heaven, yet everything about him exuded wealth, silk and velvet and brand-new leather. But he was flushed, as if he'd been running, and his hair was wind-blown and messy, and his eyes full of excitement. He bowed to me, waited for me to invite him to sit down, and then he asked me, "What was it like, monsieur, killing the wolves?" And folding his arms on the table, he stared at me. "Why don't you tell me what it's like in Paris, monsieur?" I said. And I realized right away that it sounded mocking and rude. "I'm sorry," I said immediately. "I would really like to know." "Did you go to the university?"
Did you really study with Mozart? What do people in Paris do? What do they talk about? What do they think?
He laughed softly at the barrage of questions. I had to laugh myself. I signalled for another glass and pushed the bottle towards him.
Tell me, I said, did you go to the theatres in Paris? Did you see the Comédie Française?
Many times, he answered a little dismissively. But listen, the diligence will be coming in any minute. There'll be too much noise. Allow me the honour of providing your supper in a private room upstairs. I should so like to do it. And before I could make a gentlemanly protest, he was ordering everything. We were shown up to a crude but comfortable little chamber. I was almost never in small wooden rooms, and I loved it immediately. The table was laid for the meal that would come later on. The fire was truly warming the place, unlike the roaring blazes in our castle, and the thick glass of the window was clean enough to see the blue winter sky over the snow-covered mountains.
Now, I shall tell you everything you want to know about Paris, he said agreeably, waiting for me to sit first. Yes, I did go to the university. He made a little sneer, as if it had all been contemptible. And I did study with Mozart, who would have told me I was hopeless if he hadn't needed pupils. Now, where do you want me to begin? The stench of the city, or the infernal noise of it, the hungry crowds that surround you everywhere, the thieves in every alley ready to cut your throat?
I waved all that away. His smile was very different from his tone, his manner open and appealing.
A really big Paris theatre, I said. Describe it to me. What is it like?
I think we stayed in that room for 4 solid hours, and all we did was drink and talk. He drew plans of the theatres on the tabletop with a wet finger, described the plays he had seen, the famous actors, the little houses on the boulevards. Soon he was describing all of Paris, and he'd forgotten to be cynical, my curiosity firing him as he talked of the Ile de la Cité and the Latin Quarter, the Sorbonne, the Louvre. We went on to more abstract things, how the newspapers reported events, how his student cronies gathered in cafes to argue. He told me men were restless and out of love with the monarchy, that they wanted a change in government and wouldn't sit still for very long. He told me about the philosophers, Diderot, Voltaire, Rousseau. I couldn't understand everything he said, but in rapid, sometimes sarcastic speech, he gave me a marvelously complete picture of what was going on. Of course, it didn't surprise me to hear that educated people didn't believe in God, that they were infinitely more interested in science, that the aristocracy was much in ill favour, and so was the church. These were times of reason, not superstition, and the more he talked, the more I understood. Soon he was outlining the Encyclopédie, the great compilation of knowledge supervised by Diderot. And then it was the salons he'd gone to, the drinking bouts, his evenings with actresses. He described the public balls at the Palais Royal, where Marie Antoinette appeared right along with the common people. I'll tell you, he said finally, it all sounds a hell of a lot better in this room than it really is. I don't believe you, I said gently. I didn't want him to stop talking. I wanted it to go on and on. It's a secular age, monsieur, he said, filling our glasses from the new bottle of wine. Very dangerous.
Why dangerous? I whispered. An end to superstition? What could be better than that?
Spoken like a true 18th-century man, monsieur, he said with a faint melancholy to his smile. But no one values anything any more. Fashion is everything. Even atheism is a fashion. I had always had a secular mind, but not for any philosophical reason. No one in my family much believed in God, or ever had. Of course, they said they did, and we went to Mass, but this was duty. Real religion had long ago died out in our family, as it had perhaps in the families of thousands of aristocrats. Even at the monastery I had not believed in God. I had believed in the monks around me. I tried to explain this in simple language that would not give offence to Nicholas, because for his family it was different. Even his miserable money-grubbing father, whom I secretly admired, was fervently religious. "But can man live without these beliefs?" Nicholas asked, almost sadly, Can children face the world without them? I was beginning to understand why he was so sarcastic and cynical. He had only recently lost that old faith. He was bitter about it. But no matter how deadening was this sarcasm of his, a great energy poured out of him, an irrepressible passion, and this drew me to him. I think I loved him. Another two glasses of wine and I might say something absolutely ridiculous like that. "I've always lived without beliefs," I said. "Yes, I know," he answered. "Do you remember the story of the witches? The time you cried at the witches' place?"
Cried over the witches?
I looked at him blankly for a moment. But it stirred something painful, something humiliating. Too many of my memories had that quality. And now I had to remember crying over witches.
"I don't remember," I said.
"We were little boys, and the priest was teaching us our prayers. And the priest took us out to see the place where they burnt the witches in the old days, the old stakes and the blackened ground."
"Ah, that place," I shuddered. "That horrid, horrid place."
"You began to scream and to cry. They sent someone for the Marquise herself because your nurse couldn't quiet you." "I was a dreadful child," I said, trying to shrug it off. Of course I did remember now. Screaming. Being carried home, nightmares about the fires. Someone bathing my forehead and saying, "Lestat, wake up." But I hadn't thought of that little scene in years. It was the place itself I thought about whenever I drew near it. The thicket of blackened stakes. The images of men and women and children burnt alive. Nicholas was studying me. "When your mother came to get you, she said it was all ignorance and cruelty. She was so angry with the priest for telling us the old tales." I nodded. The final horror to hear they had all died for nothing, those long-forgotten people of our own village, that they had been innocent. "Victims of superstition," she had said. "There were no real witches." No wonder I had screamed and screamed. "But my mother," Nicholas said, "told a different story. That the witches had been in league with the devil, that they'd blighted the crops, and in the guise of wolves killed the sheep and the children." "And won't the world be better if no one is ever again burnt in the name of God?" I asked. "If there is no more faith in God to make men do that to each other? What is the danger in a secular world where horrors like that don't happen?" He leaned forward with a mischievous little frown. "The wolves didn't wound you on the mountain, did they?" he asked playfully. "You haven't become a werewolf, have you, monsieur, unbeknownst to the rest of us?" He stroked the furred edge of the velvet cloak I still had over my shoulders. "Remember what the good father said, that they had burnt a good number of werewolves in those times. They were a regular menace." I laughed. "If I turn into a wolf," I answered, "I can tell you this much. I won't hang around here to kill the children. I'll get away from this miserable little hellhole of a village where they still terrify little boys with tales of burning witches. I'll get on the road to Paris and never stop till I see her ramparts." "And you'll find Paris is a miserable hellhole," he said, "where they break the bones of thieves on the wheel for the vulgar crowds in the Place de Grève."
"No," I said.
"I'll see a splendid city, where great ideas are born in the minds of the populace, ideas that go forth to illuminate the darkened corners of this world." "Ah, you are a dreamer," he said. But he was delighted. He was beyond handsome when he smiled. "And I'll know people like you," I went on. "People who have thoughts in their heads and quick tongues with which to voice them, and we'll sit in cafes, and we'll drink together, and we'll clash with each other violently in words, and we'll talk for the rest of our lives in divine excitement." He reached out and put his arm around my neck and kissed me. We almost upset the table, we were so blissfully drunk. "My lord, the wolf killer," he whispered. When the third bottle of wine came, I began to talk of my life as I'd never done before. Of what it was like each day to ride out into the mountains, to go so far I couldn't see the towers of my father's house any more, to ride above the tilled land to the place where the forest seemed almost haunted. The words began to pour out of me as they had out of him, and soon we were talking about a thousand things we had felt in our hearts, varieties of secret loneliness, and the words seemed to be essential words the way they did on those rare occasions with my mother. And as we came to describe our longings and dissatisfactions, we were saying things to each other with great exuberance, like, "Yes, yes," and "Exactly," and "I know completely what you mean," and "Yes, of course, you felt that you could not bear it," etc. Another bottle, and a new fire, and I begged Nicholas to play his violin for me. He rushed home immediately to get it. It was now late afternoon. The sun was slanting through the window, and the fire was very hot. We were very drunk. We had never ordered supper, and I think I was happier than I had ever been in my life. I lay on the lumpy straw mattress of the little bed, with my hands under my head, watching him as he took out the instrument. He put the violin to his shoulder, and began to pluck at it and twist the pegs. Then he raised the bow and drew it down hard over the strings to bring out the first note. I sat up and pushed myself back against the panelled wall and stared at him, because I couldn't believe the sound I was hearing. He ripped into the song. He tore the notes out of the violin, and each note was translucent and throbbing. His eyes were closed, his mouth a little distorted, his lower lip sliding to the side, and what struck my heart almost as much as the song itself was the way that he seemed with his whole body to lean into the music, to press his soul like an ear to the instrument. I had never known music like it. The rawness of it, the intensity, the rapid glittering torrent of notes that came out of the strings as he soared away. It was Mozart that he was playing, and it had all the gaiety, the velocity, and the sheer loveliness of everything Mozart wrote. When he'd finished, I was staring at him, and I realized I was gripping the sides of my head. "Monsieur, what's the matter?" he said almost helplessly, and I stood up and threw my arms around him, and kissed him on both cheeks, and kissed the violin. "Stop calling me, monsieur," I said. "Call me by my name." I lay back down on the bed and buried my face on my arm and started to cry, and once I'd started I couldn't stop it. He sat next to me, hugging me and asking me why I was crying, and though I couldn't tell him, I could see that he was overwhelmed that his music had produced this effect. There was no sarcasm or bitterness in him now. I think he carried me home that night. And the next morning I was standing in the crooked stone street in front of his father's shop, tossing pebbles up at his window. When he stuck his head out, I said, "Do you want to come down and go on with our conversation?" 5. From then on, when I was not hunting, my life was with Nicholas and our conversation. Spring was approaching. The mountains were dappled with green, the apple orchard starting back to life, and Nicholas and I were always together. We took long walks up the rocky slopes, had our bread and wine in the sun on the grass, roamed south through the ruins of an old monastery. We hung about in my rooms or sometimes climbed to the battlements, and we went back to our room at the inn when we were too drunk and too loud to be tolerated by others. And as the weeks passed, we revealed more and more of ourselves to each other. Nicholas told me about his childhood at school, the little disappointments of his early years, those whom he had known and loved. And I started to tell him the painful things. And finally, the old disgrace of running off with the Italian players. I came to that one night when we were in the inn again and we were drunk as usual. In fact, we were at that moment of drunkenness that the two of us had come to call the golden moment, when everything made sense. We always tried to stretch out that moment, and then inevitably one of us would confess, "I can't follow any more. I think the golden moment's past." On this night, looking out the window at the moon over the mountains, I said that at the golden moment it was not so terrible that we weren't in Paris, that we weren't at the opera or the Comédie, waiting for the curtain to rise. "You and the theatres of Paris," he said to me. "No matter what we're talking about, you bring it back to the theatres and the actors." His brown eyes were very big and trusting, and even drunk as he was, he looked spruce in his red velvet Paris frock coat.
"Actors and actresses make magic," I said. "They make things happen on the stage. They invent. They create. Wait until you see the sweat streaming down their painted faces in the glare of the footlights," he answered. "Ah, there you go again," I said. "And you, the one who gave up everything to play the violin." He got terribly serious suddenly, looking off as if he were weary of his own struggles. "That I did," he confessed. Even now the whole village knew it was war between him and his father. Nicky wouldn't go back to school in Paris.
"You make life when you play," I said.
"You create something from nothing. You make something good happen. And that is blessed to me." "I make music and it makes me happy," he said. "What is blessed or good about that?" I waved it away, as I always did his cynicism now. "I've lived all these years among those who create nothing and change nothing," I said. "Actors and musicians, they're saints to me."
"Saints?" he asked.
"Blessedness? Goodness?" "Lestat, your language baffles me." I smiled and shook my head. "You don't understand. I'm speaking of the character of human beings, not what they believe in. I'm speaking of those who won't accept a useless lie just because they were born to it. I mean those who would be something better. They work, they sacrifice, they do things." He was moved by this, and I was a little surprised that I'd said it. Yet I felt I had hurt him somehow. "There is blessedness in that," I said. "There's sanctity, and God or no God, there is goodness in it. I know this, the way I know the mountains are out there, that the stars shine." He looked sad for me, and he looked hurt still, but for the moment I didn't think of him. I was thinking of the conversation I had had with my mother, and my perception that I couldn't be good and defy my family. But if I believed what I was saying... As if he could read my mind, he asked, "But do you really believe those things?" "Maybe yes, maybe no," I said. I couldn't bear to see him look so sad. And I think more on account of that than anything else, I told him the whole story of how I'd run off with the players. I told him what I'd never told anyone, not even my mother, about those few days and the happiness they'd given me. "Now, how could it not have been good," I asked, "to give and receive such happiness? We brought to life that town when we put on our play. Magic, I tell you. It could heal the sick, it could." He shook his head, and I knew there were things he wanted to say which, out of respect for me, he was leaving to silence. "You don't understand, do you?" I asked. "Lestat, sin always feels good," he said gravely. "Don't you see that? Why do you think the church has always condemned the players? It was from Dionysus, the wine god, that the theatre came. You can read that in Aristotle. And Dionysus was a god that drove men to debauchery. It felt good to you to be on that stage because it was abandoned and lewd, the age-old service of the god of the grape, and you were having a high time of it, defying your father."
"No, Nicky. No, 1,000 times, no."
"Lestat, we're partners in sin," he said, smiling finally. "We've always been. We've both behaved badly, both been utterly disreputable. It's what binds us together." Now it was my turn to look sad and hurt, and the golden moment was gone beyond reprieve, unless something new was to happen. "Come on," I said suddenly. "Get your violin and we'll go off somewhere in the woods where the music won't wake up anybody. We'll see if there isn't some goodness in it." "You're a madman," he said, but he grabbed the unopened bottle by the neck and headed for the door immediately. I was right behind him. When he came out of his house with the violin, he said, "Let's go to the witch's place. Look, it's a half moon, plenty of light. We'll do the devil's dance and play for the spirits of the witches." I laughed. I had to be drunk to go along with that. "We'll reconsecrate the spot," I insisted, "with good and pure music." It had been years and years since I'd walked in the witch's place. The moon was bright enough, as he'd said, to see the charred stakes in their grim circle,
and the ground in which nothing ever grew even 100 years after the burnings. The new saplings of the forest kept their distance. And so the wind struck the clearing, and above, clinging to the rocky slope, the village hovered in darkness. A faint chill passed over me, but it was a mere shadow of the anguish I'd felt as a child when I'd heard those awful words, "roasted alive," when I had imagined the suffering. Nicky's white lace shoes shone in the pale light, and he struck up a gypsy song at once and danced round in a circle as he played it. I sat on a broad, burned stump of tree and drank from the bottle, and the heart-breaking feeling came, as it always did with the music. What sin was there, I thought, except to live out my life in this awful place? And pretty soon I was silently and unobtrusively crying. Though it seemed the music had never stopped, Nicky was comforting me. We sat side by side, and he told me that the world was full of inequities, and that we were prisoners, he and I, of this awful corner of France, and some day we would break out of it. And I thought of my mother in the castle high up the mountain, and the sadness numbed me until I couldn't bear it, and Nicky started playing again, telling me to dance and to forget everything. "Yes, that's what it could make you do," I wanted to say. "Is that sin? How can it be evil?" I went after him as he danced in a circle. The notes seemed to be flying up and out of the violin as if they were made of gold. I could almost see them flashing. I danced round and round him now, and he soared away into a deeper and more frenzied music. I spread the wings of the fur-lined cape and threw back my head to look at the moon. The music rose all around me like smoke, and the witch's place was no more. There was only the sky above, arching down to the mountains. We were closer for all this in the days that followed. But a few nights later, something altogether extraordinary happened. It was late. We were at the inn again, and Nicholas, who was walking about the room and gesturing dramatically, declared what had been on our minds all along. That we should run away to Paris, even if we were penniless, that it was better than remaining here. Even if we lived as beggars in Paris, it had to be better. Of course, we had both been building up to this. "Well, beggars in the streets it might be, Nicky," I said, "because I'll be damned in hell before I'll play the penniless country cousin begging at the big houses." "Do you think I want you to do that?" he demanded. "I mean run away, Lestat," he said. "Spite them, every one of them." Did I want to go on like this? So our fathers would curse us? After all, our life was meaningless here. Of course, we both knew this running off together would be 1,000 times more serious than what I had done before. We weren't boys anymore, we were men. Our fathers would curse us, and this was something neither of us could laugh off. Also, we were old enough to know what poverty meant. "What am I going to do in Paris when we get hungry?" I asked. "Shoot rats for supper?" "I'll play my violin for coins on the Boulevard du Temple, if I have to, and you can go to the theatres." Now he was really challenging me. He was saying, "Is it all words with you, Lestat? With your looks, you know, you'd be on the stage in the Boulevard du Temple in no time." I loved this change in our conversation. I loved seeing him believe we could do it. All his cynicism had vanished, even though he did throw in the word spite every 10 words or so. It seemed possible suddenly to do all this. And this notion of the meaninglessness of our lives here began to inflame us. I took up the theme again that music and acting were good because they drove back chaos. Chaos was the meaninglessness of day-to-day life, and if we were to die now, our lives would have been nothing but meaninglessness. In fact, it came to me that my mother dying soon was meaningless, and I confided in Nicholas what she had said. "I'm perfectly horrified. I'm afraid." Well, if there had been a golden moment in the room, it was gone now, and something different started to happen. I should call it the dark moment, but it was still high-pitched and full of eerie light,
We were talking rapidly, cursing this meaninglessness, and when Nicholas at last sat down and put his head in his hands, I took some glamorous and hearty swigs of wine and went to pacing and gesturing as he had done before. I realized aloud in the midst of saying it that even when we die, we probably don't find out the answer as to why we were ever alive. Even the avowed